The scripture reading today will be taken out of 1 Peter, 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. Again, that's 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. It reads, "In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives, as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. Your adornment must not be merely external, braiding of the hair and wearing golden jewelry or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered."
Well, good morning. When I was last before you in this capacity, that was 2 weeks ago, I began a lesson on how to have happy marriages and families, and didn't finish that lesson. So for those of you who weren't present then, and for those of you who were present but don't remember that I started a lesson that I didn't finish, I'm going to go back and review quickly. So the real danger of that is twofold. One, that means if I review, I probably won't repeat things that you will remember, as long as I don't repeat any of the interesting things that I said, because that's what you will have remembered. And the other danger is that if I go back and review, I may not finish today either. So it was kind of a tough decision, but I do think we need to go back and review. And so I began, first of all, to say that if you're going to have happy families, happy marriages, it has to begin with loyalty. It has to begin with commitment. And of course, that's the way the Bible begins from the Garden of Eden with marriage, that God said it's not good for the man to be alone. And so he made for the man a woman. And you may recognize that he made one woman. He made Eve. He didn't make Eve and Rachel and Lilith just in case Eve wasn't satisfactory. There was one woman for one man. And in fact, when Jesus in Matthew chapter 19 goes back and comments on that very event, he says, "What God has put together, let no man put asunder." And of course, the difficulties that marriages face today really kind of center on the issue of easy divorces. Every marriage has some kinds of difficult circumstances. Adam and Eve had some difficulty, some crisis, and some occasion to blame one another. And in fact, it may very well have been that when Adam said to God, "It's the woman whom you gave to me that caused me to sin," had there been an option of getting another wife, he might very well have done so on that occasion. But there was no option about that. And in fact, when we get married, we hope and we expect that our husband or our wife will be there for us regardless, no matter what the circumstances. And if that's the case on that side, then we need to provide the same kind of security for them. It's loyalty that is absolute, or it's not loyalty at all. If it could be a relationship that was broken over this issue or that issue, then obviously it can be broken over any issue, but that's not the option that God provides. And if we're going to have happy and contented marriages, you need to understand going in, it is an absolute commitment, and you have the right to expect that same absolute commitment from your husband or from your wife. And that means loyalty to the children too. As little as parents like to hear from children who are old enough to say it, that "I didn't ask to be born," that's the absolute truth of the matter. And when we bring children into the world, we have to have an absolute, complete, total, unyielding loyalty to those children. That is what God expects of us. That's why He has entrusted those children to us. It means, if we want to have happy marriages and happy families, that there has to be a sense of all of the members that the family is more important than anything else in this world, more important than anything else except for our relationship to God and our eternal destiny. We have to be confident of that loyalty and that relationship. And, of course, we express that in some ways by saying home is where when you go, they have to take you in. That we understand the nature of, other expression, blood is thicker than water. That family is important. That's where it begins. And then secondly, I made the point about communication. You have to communicate with one another. Now, that may be talking or that may be some other forms of communication, but you have to, in the words of the communication professors, you have to create a common understanding in some way between the husband and the wife if they're going to be satisfied and happy in the relationship. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. And of course, we all like to recognize that we're those previous six verses to the wife and one verse to the husband, but it is a pretty important verse, and really it cuts both ways when Peter, by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, says to the husbands, you need to live with them with understanding. You need to understand your wife. Husbands have to live with their wives in such a way that they understand them, and that means that you got to talk to them. And you got to listen to them talk. That's the way, principally, that we create a common understanding. It's amazing in this day and age when we bounce signals off of satellites, when we communicate with cell phones that we carry around in our pockets, that we communicate over the internet with Facebook and Twitter and email, that in this day and age, husbands and wives, if surveys are to be believed, spend only less than half an hour talking to one another every day. And that conversation, not always really about creating common understanding. Often it is just in passing, you go get this and I'll go do this. It is not the real kind of communication that creates understanding. It's not self-disclosure. We have to talk about who we are to those who are important to us. And one of the complaints that we frequently hear in marriage, he never talks to me, and he says she doesn't understand me. Well, of course she doesn't understand you because you never made yourself understandable. You never talked to her about important things. We have to communicate with one another. And I'll tell you this, parents and children too, you got to talk to the children. And of course, early on, they want to talk to you about everything. You got to listen to that. Because there's a time coming when you have small children, they get to be teenagers, and you're going to want to know what's going on in their lives. And the only way they're going to talk to you then is if you've established a pattern and a habit of communication in the early years of their lives. We have to communicate with one another. And a part of that, number three, is that we have to argue fairly. You have to put away, as the Apostle Paul said in Ephesians 4 and verse 3, all of that kind of wrath and anger and quarreling and dissension, all of that has to be excluded from the relationship. It's going to be true that husbands and wives are going to have difficulty. I've had some children tell me about their parents, they never argued. And that's all to the good because it means that the parents have argued where the children didn't recognize it was a threat to their existence. But they're pretty much oblivious if they think their parents have never argued with one another. They always argue. There are always differences of opinion between two mature and intelligent individuals. The issue is how do you handle those problems, those disagreements? Do you fight fair? Sometimes in the sensualized age in which we live, we presume that the real measure of the happiness of a marriage is in terms of their sexual relationship. And it's clear that God understood that as part of the cement that binds a man and a woman together. But the real demonstration of the quality of a relationship is not in the quality of the sex, it's in the quality of the quarreling. Do they quarrel with one another in ways that are not destructive, not self-destructive? can they engage in solving their problems or finding a way to put their problems on hold that is not going to destroy the relationship? And there are a number of things about that. When you argue, you can't get hysterical. You can't be outrageous in your demands on the other person. You can't say things that are going to be hurtful and destructive. You have to guard your tongue. James doesn't really apply that exposition in James chapter 3 on the tongue to marriage specifically, but it clearly is applicable there as everywhere else. What a great fire is set by what is such a small thing. How much destruction comes out of the words that we say. As one cartoon character said, with more truth than maybe even the creator recognized, my marriage has been saved by the things I haven't said. There are things that you ought not to say. Once said, you can't get them back. And you need to learn to disagree by being careful not to say those things that you are going to regret later. The moment you say them, you know, I shouldn't have said that. But you can't take it back. Once it's said, it's out there. We need to learn to quarrel in some less destructive way. And likewise, someone said, it's not a matter of just not being hysterical. It's a matter of not being historical. You can't just keep bringing up all things over and over again. We need to learn to forgive and forget in the way that God forgives us, especially in a family. We need to learn to put those things in the past. We've dealt with that. That's not going to keep coming up over and over and over again. You can't deal with that kind of a relationship. And we have to learn to give the other person some time. People don't always operate on the same schedule. Some people are ready to fight and make up and get over it pretty quickly. Others, you know, they work a little slower about that. They will admit they're wrong if you give them enough time to adjust to the idea. But you can't force them into that. You have to give them enough time. On the other hand, we don't want to let our arguments, we don't want to let our anger fester and linger and create long-term problems in the relationship. We have to learn to argue fairly. And then, number four, we have to do things together. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. Live with them in understanding. And living together in understanding is not just a matter of the fact that you're coming in and out of the same door every morning. That's not really what living together is. It is companionship. It is spending time together that is together time. It is something more than just being in the same place at the same time. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 5, even in the Old Testament, even in a period of time when the sociologists think there was no such thing as romantic love, even back then God understood and commanded the Israelites in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 5, when a man's taken a new wife, he shall not go to war or be charged with any business. He shall be free at home for 1 year and bring happiness to the wife whom he has taken. Of course, there are two sides to that. One is that he's got a year, that first year of the relationship, really important to establish that. Secondly, it really kind of is a part to recognize that it is the responsibility of the husband to give happiness to his wife. That is a concern. And we do that by spending time with one another. We get caught up in the urgent and forget about the important things of life. There's not a person here who doesn't understand, I think, that family relationships, that marital relationships, that parent-child relationships are not more important than business. And yet business is urgent. Business is insistent. And we end up spending more time with those things that are less important than we spend with the things that we know are important. We have to learn to invest our time in that which is critically important. You don't get anything without spending time with it. You don't become proficient with a musical instrument. You don't become proficient at any kind of sport without investing time in it. You don't have a nice yard without investing time in it. You don't have a successful business without investing time in it. You don't have an education without investing time in it. Now, for some of those things, we can pay other people to invest the time, like the yard, like the business. But you can't develop a skill for your own by paying somebody else to do that. You can't develop education or knowledge without investing the time into it. And likewise, you can't have a happy husband, you can't have a happy wife, you can't have happy children, you can't have happy parents without investing some time into that. If that's important to you, then you've got to spend the time. Spend the time with your spouse. Spend the time with your children. And of course, anybody who's had any number of children know, you know, that that's kind of like, you know, it's one of those things that's like a U-shaped curve, like so many things in life are. First time you have a child, and the first time you want to read a book to them, that's like, oh man, this is exciting. Look, my child is actually sitting here in my lap, and I'm reading this book to them. Look at the little dog and his tongue hanging out. Isn't that amazing? By the third time you read that book, it's not so much fun. By the third time with the third child, it's not any fun at all. The first time you sit on the floor to stack blocks, it's like, are you kidding me? This is the most important thing in my life. By the 105th time, it is not quite so much fun. But here's the thing. You spend that time. You do it over and over and over again. And more than likely, you'll begin to see new and important vistas within that very simple kind of an activity. It is critical, not only for the child's sake, but for our sake, that we spend the time with them. Sometimes it seems to us, perhaps, as a waste of time. Senator Brooks, from an age in which people actually did keep journals or diaries, wrote in his diary one day, I spent the day fishing with my son, a wasted day. His son, imitating his father, was trying to keep a diary too, and in his childish sprawl he wrote, fished with father, greatest day ever. Time with a child is not wasted, C.S. Lewis said. And it's not just on the child's part that it's not wasted. It's on our side, too, that it is not wasted. We are refreshed. We are reinvigorated. We are changed by the time we spend with our children. And that guarantees the long-term relationship we have with those children into the future. I walk in the mornings about an hour. And I've started listening several years ago to audiobooks on headphones on my phone. Most mornings, I don't get to listen to too much of a book anymore because one or the other of my children calls me because they know I'm out walking. I guess they feel sorry for me or something, but, you know. And that's like one of the greatest things in life is they want to talk to me now at this point in life. And that doesn't happen, I don't think, unless you spend time talking to them when they're younger. Okay, that's a review. And now we move on to number five, I think. Now, some of you might have kept notes and you may say, wait a minute, we did number five last time. Number five, appreciation. We have to learn to appreciate one another. We have to learn to appreciate our husband, appreciate our wife, appreciate our children. Now, some of you may say that sounds like a pretty weak word compared to the word that we expect to use here, the word that the world likes to use here, love. And love, in so much as it might mean a sense of passion, is important, but that's not really what I'm talking about here so much. I'm talking about the idea of recognizing the other person's good qualities and appreciating the things that they have and the things that they are that are good and valuable to you. And that kind of appreciation is really relatively rare in the world, even rare between husbands and wives. Many people marry with the idea of reforming or making their husband or their wife better. Making them over, even. But that's not going to work very well. In the long term, people are kind of what they are. And we are improved, no doubt, by the fact that we're married. And some people we can choose to marry will improve us more than other people we might choose to marry. But ultimately, to marry someone because you're going to fix them is going to lead just to misery and heartache. We need to appreciate the people that they are. We need to think to ourselves every day, I can't believe how blessed I am to have this husband, to have this wife. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9. Ecclesiastes is a mighty interesting book. And on the one hand, you read it and you say, this is depressing. On the other hand, you say, well, it's not so bad because it means everybody's depressed as I am. But really, there are some kernels of truth in here that suggest we ought to find, in the midst of all the futility that is the world, things that are valuable. And Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9 is one of those. Some years ago, when one of Wanda's aunts passed away, they were dividing up things, and of course, you know, we got lots of valuable things, including a Bible stand, which is like, I don't know, why would you have a Bible stand? But we had a Bible stand, and so, you know, if you put a Bible on a Bible stand, it's supposed to be opened. And it's like, that's a pretty interesting question. What page would you open it to? Have you ever thought of that? That's one of the reasons not to have a Bible stand, because it's like, if I go into your house and you have a Bible stand and you got the Bible open, I want to see what page you chose to open it to. So anyway, for the brief time we had it out, I had it open to Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he's given to you under the sun. For this is your reward in life, and in your toil in which you have labored under the sun. Well, see, that's what I mean about Ecclesiastes. You know, it's kind of like depressing, and then on the other hand, you say, well, like, that's not quite so bad. But, you know, there is a kernel of truth here that marriage is a blessing that God has given to us, and we need to appreciate that. We need to appreciate the very fact of marriage, and we need to appreciate the person that we're married to. We need to understand this person to the point that we can say, this is their good qualities. I am amazed at my husband or my wife or my children that they can do these things. That's what creates this sense of happiness and joy in the relationship. And sometimes, of course, it's a matter of the more we understand them or the more similar we are, the better we can appreciate them. It's one of the things that we think about when we think about choosing to marry the right kind of person. Can you be happy with this person? Well, only if you can appreciate them. And you need to learn that about them before you get married. Not really so much about the passion, not really so much about, you know, even the capabilities, but do you appreciate this person? Are there some things about them that you appreciate? And that's why we do the marriage surveys about similarity. Harvard professors suggested, maybe a little tongue-in-cheek, that you can predict marital satisfaction based on the similarity of two people's answers to three questions. Three questions. If they answer them the same, they probably can get along well, okay? Number one, do you like horror movies? Number two, have you ever traveled by yourself in a foreign country? And number three, do you think it would be great to sell everything you have and live on a sailboat? Well, those are pretty fundamental kind of questions. And if you don't agree about those, it's like, that would be pretty hard to appreciate that life a person wanted to live. Of course, there are more important questions than that we need to agree on. Like, do you believe in God? Do you think that that's the most important thing about our lives together, is that we serve God? Now you can appreciate, as a Christian, somebody who has that kind of interest. Appreciation. And you look every day for the kind of things that you can appreciate in the other person. I spoke to you a few weeks ago about injustice collectors based on 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 5. That is, that love does not keep a record of things that have been suffered or wrongs or injuries that have been suffered. We call those people injustice collectors. They're always just sensitive, waiting for something bad to happen, for somebody to hurt their feelings, for somebody to forget their birthday, for somebody to mess up somehow. And then they're like, oh, injured about that. And they keep it close. It's like precious to them that they've got this against you. Injustice collectors. You don't want to be around injustice collectors. You don't want to be an injustice collector. You want to give that up. What you want to be is a diamond hunter. That is, you want to be the kind of person who is looking to find good things about the other person. You want to try and be the kind of person, and you want to live with the kind of person who always recognizes and appreciates the good things that you do. And maybe even you didn't even think it was that good, and they say to you, that was a good thing. You want to live with that kind of a person, and you want to be that kind of a person. We all want really the same thing, to be appreciated. He says, I don't know if I can keep going at work or at home without her support or her approval. And she says, I'm just empty. My whole life seems meaningless, unimportant. Why? Because they don't get the kind of appreciation from their spouse that they need, that they deserve, that God intended in a marriage relationship. They both want the same thing, and they both could provide the same thing to the other. One of the best prescriptions for healthy marriage is a compliment a day. You know, they say an apple a day keeps the doctor away. A compliment a day keeps unhappiness away from a marriage relationship. You have to try and find that. Can you give them a compliment once a day? There ought to be something this day you can compliment them on. Something, surely. Of course, the difficulty if you start thinking about it, if you're a diamond hunter, is which thing will I compliment them about today? Because there's so many things I could compliment them on. A compliment a day does two things for you. One, it makes your spouse feel good. There's nothing we like so much as a compliment. Somebody recognizing something that we did and appreciating it. And the second thing it will do for you is you feel better about people that you've complimented. You hear yourself saying, they did this well or they did that well. And you think, well, yeah, I'm a pretty reliable witness. They must be pretty good people because I keep complimenting them. And because you're looking for the good things to compliment, you learn to appreciate them. And of course, same thing's true for parents and children, you know, teenagers. You know, that's the second most frequent thing they say. The first thing is, my parents don't understand me. Of course, when you're a teenager, you're unique and special, and nobody understands you because you're so special. But, you know, the other thing they say is, my parents never notice the hundreds of good things I do, but let me mess up just once, and they are all over me about that. And of course, as parents, that's our tendency. You know, we're always tweaking. We're always trying to get them a little better, and the better they are, the more we're determined to get them the next 0.1% to being 100% perfect. Don't forget in that tweaking that you need to express appreciation for the things that they are, for the people that they are and the things that they do. And this kind of appreciation, husbands and wives ought to have for one another. Parents and children ought to have, I didn't say that. Parents do a lot for their children, even when they're just kind of average, ordinary parents. I mean, I think Leland just mentioned that at the collection. You know, parents have everything. You know, from a small child's point of view, they're rich. They got everything. They've got all the time. They got all the transportation. They got all the money. They control the refrigerator, and they control the TV. They got everything. And they're generous enough to share it with their children. Even the most selfish parents give so much to their children, and children just, they don't seem to ever appreciate that. It's like they just take it for granted. When I was growing up, three brothers, we worked all day, usually with my dad, construction work. We'd come home, mother would have supper on the table. You know, plenty of iced tea, sweet iced tea in those days, you know. And, you know, we'd been hot working, we'd drink that down and then rattle our glass with the ice in it. Makes it make my dad so mad. But mom, you know, you rattled glass, she'd get up and pour you some more. I mean, did she notice before you had the rattled glass, she would pour you some more tea? My dad, you know, he was like, you don't treat your mother that way. All the things she has done for you since you were a little baby in diapers, you don't treat her that way. But we take for granted the people that we live with. We take for granted the things that are the greatest blessings in our life. We take for granted the people that are most important to us. We need to learn to appreciate one another if we want to have happy families. And spiritual wellness, number six. That's the key to having a happy family. Spiritual wellness that permeates each of the members. The family that prays together does indeed stay together. None of the rest of all of these things we've talked about in terms of communication or appreciation or in terms of arguing fair really can take place unless we have the same kind of value system. We need to be righteous and godly people if we want to have happy families. Now, everybody in the world has values, of course. It's not just Christians and Bible believers that have values. But so often, the values they have are selfish values. What guides their behavior and is the standard of their valuing and making choices about things, about situations, is really associated just with their changing feelings. They feel good about it, so they value it. But tomorrow, they may not feel good about it. Feeling had them today, it doesn't have them tomorrow. They don't even remember the feelings tomorrow they had today. And then it comes back and they don't even remember they didn't feel that way in one day in between. If your values are situational, if your values are tied to your feelings, your emotions, then you really don't have a value system. It is so variable, you don't have an ethic. It's just situationally determined. The only kind of value system that is really a value system, the only kind of values that are really an ethical, moral system are the sort of values that are embedded in the character, the unchanging, eternal character of God. And that means that sometimes you have to do things you don't really at the moment feel like you want to do. That's what having a value system means. It can't be flexible and situationally determined, don't you see? Or you can't, it's not really a value system. It just suits the changing feelings of the moment. Either marriage is for life or it's uncertain, depending on the feelings that you have. Either it's wrong to lie or the truth then is just subject to our emotional judgments at the moment in time. We have to have a value system that's embedded in something external, embedded in something that's unchangeable. And that really can only be the character of God. You know, we ought to recognize that's the case. We have enough trouble agreeing about the application to specific situations of absolute principles in the Scripture, don't we? We can disagree with people. Sometimes we say, even reasonable, righteous people can disagree with one another when we're trying to apply an absolute principle. If that's difficult to apply the same way, an absolute principle, it's absolutely impossible for us to agree with one another if we have our own selfish, self-centered, changing value system. That's going to doom any relationship. It's one of the most radically destructive things about marriages that you can imagine is that two parties don't value the same kinds of things. It doesn't seem that way sometimes to young people who are passionate about one another. But it becomes evident as they live together. When you family many years ago, and mother and father were, you know, very regular attenders and, you know, participated in the Bible study and were, so far as we could determine, spiritual-minded folks. Their children, not so much so. And one of the children, the boy, married a girl that looked a lot like him, had a lot of the same kind of interests. They were both blonde and tanned and athletic and engaged in sports, and they were very happy together until the child was born. Then it turns out he finally recognized she was a Catholic and he was a member of the Church of Christ. They had never talked about that until the child was born. And you know what problems that created? I see some of you are nodding your head or shaking your head because you've heard the same sad story. And she was determined the boy would be a Catholic, though that had never seemed important to her. And he was determined the boy wouldn't be a Catholic. And they ended up being divorced. And in fact, finally, the mother of the child got an injunction against the grandparents so that when the child was visiting with the grandparents, they couldn't take the child to church services. value system has to be the same, or you're going to have some significant problems. We have to have that kind of strong system of values to stay together. Something that's unchanging, doesn't depend on the circumstances, doesn't depend on our feelings. And we need to impart that to our children. Children are taught responsibility by holding them responsible, for their misdeeds. That means they got to make some kind of restitution if they mess up. There has to be some kind of punishment if they break the rules that they're capable of understanding. And of course, all of that has to be commensurate with their ability. And as their ability to be responsible increases, we have to give them more and more responsibility. And of course, that's always a delicate kind of job of understanding at what point they can be responsible for setting their own hours, or at what point they can be responsible for driving a car, or at what point they can be responsible for choosing their own breakfast cereal. But we have to give them that kind of responsibility. Then we have to hold them to account when they are irresponsible. We need to have this common standard to solve our problems. It's what Paul, I think, one application, at least what Paul intends in Ephesians 6 and verse 14. Stand, therefore, having girded your waist with truth and having put on the breastplate of righteousness. There are some things that are absolutely wrong. And a Christian takes their stand and they says, this is wrong. It doesn't fit. And if you have a family, a husband and a wife who take the same stand, and the children who stand with them about that, that is the key, really, for them being happy together and solving their problems. And you will have problems. There's no doubt about that. There is not a life that is not fraught with problems. There's not a marriage that is not fraught with some kind of problems, either from outside or from inside. And this is the real strength and the real test of the happiness of a family, is whether they can deal with those kinds of problems. Back in the 1980s, social psychologists went out and studied families. And he picked out strong families to see what were the characteristics of these strong families, many of the things that we're talking about in this lesson. And then after he'd published that, written a book about it, it was all pretty kind of exciting. Somebody came to him a decade later and they said, well, what are those families doing now? And he said, that's a good question. So he went back to visit those families. And what he found was every single one of those families in the intervening decade had had some significant crisis to deal with. Every one of them had had something significant, from the death of one of the parents or the death of a child or a serious illness or a financial reversal. Every one of them had had to deal with some kind of problem. But what he found too was, because they had those qualities, including a strong value system, they were able to withstand that. They were able to come through it intact, maybe even drawn closer to one another because of the problems that they experienced. There are many kinds of problems that couples face. Maybe one of the first of those is going to be the issue about money. We need to understand, when we create a marriage and a family, that we can't start where our parents probably have arrived at by the time we think about what it means to be married or to have a family. We're not going to have that same kind of standard of living, probably. But that's okay, because that's not even really the most important thing in life. We need to understand what Paul had to say about learning to be content with the situation in which we are. That godliness is indeed a matter of great gain, that we need those things in our life. And if we have that, then we're not going to be taken in by the masters of deception that is the advertising industry today. But if we are selfish and self-centered and prideful and think we deserve better, we're not going to be happy no matter what we have, because we're going to let them tell us that what we have is not good enough for us. A young bride slams the refrigerator door every time she gets something out. And of course, that gets to be pretty aggravating after a while. Why does she slam the door? She's got a refrigerator that keeps things cold, but it isn't quite like the one she sees advertised. And she thinks to herself, I need that refrigerator. She thinks to herself, I deserve that refrigerator. She's not learned to be content in the circumstances in which she's found herself. She's not learned to be a diamond hunter, looking for the good things in life. And she's going to be miserable, and she's going to make her husband miserable. But it's not just the wives, of course. It's the husbands who bankrupt the family because they have elaborate schemes for, you know, a bigger house or for a nicer car or from expensive kind of hobby. We need to learn to be content in the situation in which we find ourselves. We need to learn to be selfless and appreciate the better things in life. Conclusion. Well, my wife says, be nice, work hard, be tolerant, control your temper, and be happy. Kind of like the Boy Scout code, and that probably works pretty well. That's where we want to get. But the truth of the matter is the things that are going to get us to that point, to happy families and happy marriages, are not psychological tricks, not some special techniques. Everything that I have said, I hope, springs directly out of biblical principles. Otherwise, they wouldn't be of any value. It's the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It is the idea of Psalm 15, who is fit to dwell in the holy hill of the Lord? Those who strike hands to their hurt and change not, loyalty and commitment. It is the admonition of the Lord in Matthew chapter 6, lay up for yourself treasures in heaven and not on earth. It is the admonition of the Apostle Paul, redeem the time and walk circumspectly. It is what the whole scriptures say to us, think more highly of others than you think of yourselves. Let the law of kindness dwell on your lips and learn to be content in whatever circumstances you find yourself. We can, because God intends for us to have happy marriages and happy families. We can have the blessings that God intends for us in our marriage and in our family. He has done so much more for us than just provide us the blessing of family, of course. As Leland reminded us, the marriage relationship is the one that he uses to liken his relationship to his people. It is the idea that he wants us to be united with him. Despite our sins, we can have a relationship with God, and we can enjoy the blessings of that relationship through Jesus Christ, who has done so much for us. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, that's the first order of business. If you're a Christian, you're not living with Jesus in your heart and in your lives. If you're not displaying that in your relationship with everyone else, that's the second order of business, particularly within your family. But at this moment, Jesus is with us, and he invites you to come if you have need to respond to his invitation.